Brewer's yeast is an essential ingredient in beer, but when certain strains of yeast land in the wrong place, they can spoil fresh beer by changing the alcohol content, altering the flavor, and sometimes even making bottles explode. Now a group of brewers and microbiologists have discovered the solution to this problem could be other yeasts called killer yeasts. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about the local connection to this discovery and what it means for craft brewers are Rheingeist Brewery Quality Assurance Manager Nicholas Ketchum. Thanks for being here, Nick.
Thank you.
And University of Idaho Associate Professor in the Department of Biological Sciences, Paul Rowley. Welcome, Paul.
Oh, hi there. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you both. Nick, tell us about these strains of brewer's yeast that can cause problems. Like, what are they and what are some of the problems they can cause for brewers?
Yeah, so colloquially in the brewing industry, we refer to them as diastatic yeasts. Generally speaking, more often than not, we'll bring these yeasts into the brewery ourselves.
On purpose. Oh, really?
Yeah, to try to make Belgian styles of beer. A lot of the diastatic yeast strains that are out there that we know about come from Belgian styles. And Belgian styles tend to be very dry as a result, but we do it anyway because we really like Belgian beer. But then also there are some wild yeasts out there that are diastatic and will come in incidentally or on accident. So
we can blame Belgium for this?
That's we what can, you're yes.
Okay.
Get on the phone with the ambassador right
That's
now.
Right. And what I mentioned that they can change the alcohol content. What's going on? Why can they cause such problems?
Well, and Paul can probably speak to this too, but a long time ago, there was a gene fusion between a flocculation gene, which allows yeast to stick together, and a glucoamylase that's used during sporulation called SGA1. And it allowed yeast to express an extracellular glucoamylase, which they previously couldn't. And that enzyme just helps break down a lot of the dextrins that are left over after the brewing process. And it creates a lot of CO2, a lot of alcohol, a lot of off flavors like phenolics, which kind of smell smoky or like Band-Aid. They generally just cause havoc.
Wow. Paul, how common is this problem?
Oh, well, that's a really good question. And I guess that it's a well-kept secret by the brewing industry. People like to talk about it.
Yeah.
Because of generally, having spoilage, having exploding bottles, having your product taste bad. I mean, these are all important factors for any brewing operation. And so a lot of the times, the way the breweries deal with this is they destroy the batch of beer. Many facilities lack the means to pasteurize their beer. And so at the first sign of contamination, the beer will be destroyed. So there isn't really any control methods in preventing this type of contamination as it currently stands.
Well, let's talk more about that, Paul, because I understand that this is something craft brewers face, but the big corporations don't because of pasteurization. What does pasteurization do to solve this problem? How does that work?
So people may be more familiar with pasteurization with respect to milk, treatment of milk. All the milk is homogenized and pasteurized, and it's just a way of essentially heating foodstuffs to a reasonably to just below boiling. And just for very, very short periods of time. And that essentially reduces the number of organisms that are living within, in one case, milk, but also in the case of beer as well. And so by injuring these microorganisms, bacteria, yeasts, you can essentially extend the shelf life of any of these products. And for a diastatic contamination, you would essentially be able to remove the contaminating diastatic yeasts.
So, Nick, dumb question. Why don't craft breweries just pasteurize their beer to avoid the problem?
Oh, if only it was that simple. pasteurizers, while awesome, are super duper expensive. A lot of the ones that even are marketed towards craft breweries, they can be upwards of $100,000 or oftentimes way, way more. And most craft breweries are really small businesses, run by either a family or a small group of friends. And they just don't have the capital usually to fund those sorts of activities. So there really isn't another option for craft breweries. We face either dumping it down the drain and eating the cost or taking a risk and putting it out there.
Yeah. We're talking about a new solution to a sticky problem for craft brewers. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk at wvxu.org. So, Nick, we're going to get to these killer yeasts. But before we do, in the past, have craft brewers had a way to really detect the presence of these diastatic yeasts in their beer?
Yeah. One of the most amazing innovations that's happened in craft breweries over the last decade has been PCR, or the use of polymerase chain reaction, to detect an early screening assay for these diastatic yeasts. Basically, it's sort of a forensic tool that allows you to amplify the amount of DNA that is in there. And because this is a DNA-based problem, it's a gene that expresses an enzyme, we're able to query essentially each sample that comes to the cellar with these specific primers, and these primers will allow us to find the presence of this gene. And that, as a tool, has allowed us to, very early on in the brewing process, know whether or not a particular beer is going to go bad. Prior to this, we had to use cultivation. We had to grow these yeasts. And growing diastatic yeast is probably one of the hardest things you can do. They're very finicky, and the methods that existed prior to, I would say, 2016 were really dicey. You had to use a media called LCSM, and oftentimes you'd get a lot of false positives, meaning that you would think they were there, but they weren't. So PCR really helped push the industry forward, and we've gotten a lot better about not putting that type of product that might be contaminated out on the shelves.
And PCR, that sounds familiar from COVID testing. Is it in the same kind of realm of science there?
Exactly the same. It's the same exact technology. With COVID, you're just looking for presence of viral DNA. And here we're just looking for the presence of yeast DNA.
Wow. Okay, so if you had found it in the past with these PCR tests, you'd have to dump the beer. Nobody wants to have to do that because that's expensive, a big waste. Explain the story, Nick, behind this new method of dealing with these yeast strains. I mean, you discovered this, right? Talk about how that happened.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a sort of spontaneous moment of clarity that I had when I was teaching over at Cincinnati State. I was an adjunct at the time, and I was writing a lecture on types of yeast that are bad for breweries. So all of our students are all going into breweries, and so I wanted them to know about them. And killer yeast actually can be a problem in a brewery on its own. If a killer yeast strain gets into your fermenters, it'll produce this killer toxin and actually inhibit the growth of the brewing strain you're trying to use to make that beer with. And I remember in the writing the lecture, I was talking about how specific the killer yeast toxins were, and that it would really kill any strain of Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And simultaneously, at the same time, in my side hustle at Rheingeist, we were struggling with three diastatic contaminations, three different ones at the same time, and we made the realization that we were going to have to dump all the beer. And so those thoughts just kind of coalesced in my mind at the same time, and I was like, you know what? I bet you could probably use killer yeast to inhibit diastatic yeast.
So you're basically sending like little yeast assassins into the contaminated beer?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Wow. So, Paul, you and your graduate students tested this solution. First, what did you think when you first talked to Nick about this? And then what did you all find?
Yeah, it's a really fun story, actually, because, you know, normally people don't talk about killer yeast, right? It's a very niche area of study in science. And, you know, the interest in killer yeast peaked, I would say, around the 1990s. And so my lab's just sort of been studying this as a purely intellectual curiosity, but also thinking about the applications of killer yeasts to prevent, you know, human disease, agricultural disease, any other type of disease you could think of, we've been trying to pitch and trying to sort of get some headway on. And then, of course, Nick did a podcast, actually. I think it was a Master Brewers podcast. And when that came up on my internet feed, I literally listened to it and picked up the phone and gave Nick a call because I'd never heard of diastatic yeasts either. And so this has been really fun and very, very useful collaboration, because through collaboration, through Nick's initial work and through our ongoing collaboration, I honestly believe that we have potential to solve the issue of diastatic contaminations using killer yeasts.
I want to back up for a minute, Paul, because you said you've been studying killer yeasts to attack diseases and things in humans. I mean, that's a whole other conversation, but can you tell us just a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. I mean, it's well known that killer yeasts have limitations. The toxins that they produce are very specific to different types of fungi. And so in the literature, it's been shown that you can't kill every type of disease-causing organism with killer yeasts. And so that's known. And so what we've been trying to look at is, are there any ways we can sort of break through that limitation? And that's what my laboratory is interested in. And we've essentially looked at using killer yeasts to essentially prevent the growth of yeasts that cause human disease. And that essentially are rated by the CDC and the World Health Organization as emerging threats to human health. And we have some traction on that. But the hurdles of going from a scientific discovery to an actual product, it's a long and complicated process. And if I'm honest, working with killer yeast in brewing is a lot more straightforward. And if I'm honest, a lot more fun.
There you go. Yep. It sounds like these are like the Liam Neesons of yeast. They have a very specific set of skills, right? That's what's going on here.
Yep.
So, Nick, why are these killer yeast toxins called killer yeast? Can they be harmful for people to consume if they're floating around in your beer and killing the stuff you want them to kill? Can they hurt people?
That's a great question, and one that I've received so many times. No, they're actually quite harmless to humans. Paul mentioned before the huge amount of specificity these toxins have for their targets. And we actually consume killer yeast toxins quite regularly if you drink wine. One of the most common red wine yeasts is a killer yeast. And it makes sense in that context, because most fermentations, there are yeasts that are endogenous to the grape skins. And so there's a lot of competition in wine fermentation. And so selectively, winemakers have found killer yeast are very good at fermenting wine because they out-compete all the other wild yeasts that are on grape skins.
Wow, they're good at their jobs.
Very good. Huh. They're very Liam Neeson-like.
What, Paul, do you have a sense, and I'll ask Nick too, but do you have a sense for what the solution could cost a brewery and how that compares to the cost of other ways to try to, you know, get rid of these wayward bacteria and yeasts?
Right. I mean, we're looking at several potential ways of applying killer yeast to this problem. And I guess the biggest thing to say is, short of buying a pasteurizer, there are no effective ways of getting rid of a diastatic contamination. So anything is better than nothing is one way of looking at it. But this can be viewed in two different ways. You can either think about it as a preventative mechanism. So you could potentially use killer yeast to make beer. There are brewing strains that produce killer toxins. So there is that possibility. So in other words, if you're just making beer like with wine with killer yeasts, then you're likely to be protected. But you need to know which strains can produce toxins that are most effective at inhibiting this contaminating organism. Alternatively, you could detect a diastatic contamination event, and then you could just add a killer yeast into the brewing mixture to essentially kill off all the contaminating yeasts. So there are two options, both of which will essentially use living yeasts as the solution. So, and brewers are very good at propagating yeasts and very good at handling yeasts. So the expertise would likely be minimum required for implementing the technology. And again, with growing yeasts, it's relatively cheap. This is not a technically heavy procedure that we would envision would protect.
How is Rheingeist approaching this, Nick? I mean, are you setting killers loose in your beer when you detect these diastatic yeasts?
We have tried that actually on a number of occasions. We've done, I think, two or three pilot studies where we've done 10 hectoliter fermentations and we've intentionally spiked these fermenters with an absolutely gross amount of contamination. And we've seen that it can successfully rescue over attenuation, which is when the yeast are eating sugar. We call that attenuation because it's bringing the amount of sugar down. And it will do that quite effectively and consistently. The only thing that we really struggle with is the off flavors, because those diastatic yeast are present and they're still doing metabolism. If we try to do it that specific way, we tend to still struggle with the off flavors. But Paul mentioned if we use one that is already killer, those diastatic yeast won't have a chance to grow. So
have you started doing, I mean, I don't want you to give away company secrets, but have you started doing that, like killer beer with killer yeasts?
We have not tried that yet. Paul and I are currently co-authoring a grant to the National Science Foundation to get funding to do more studies on this, because as well as that question, we need to answer what the long-term stability of this toxin is and how much protection and for how long we'll get out of these types of products. So it's an open question.
Yeah. I don't mean to sound too sci-fi with this, but Paul, is there any risk these killer yeasts could like go rogue and start going after something else?
So I guess the way you could look at it is that the killer yeasts are actually pretty prevalent in nature. One of the projects that my lab is working on is essentially looking at the prevalence of killer toxin production and killer yeast in the environment. So we're looking at association with insects, and we're actually finding quite a lot of killer yeast that are already present in the environment. A lot of them have novel activities, novel ways of killing yeasts. So there's a huge diversity already out there. And I would argue that, you know, nature's already done the hard work. We've already got a huge diversity of toxins out there. I don't see there being any, unexpected consequences of using these toxins in brewing. As Nick said, that they are very specific. The toxins we would likely use would be ones that have been already studied through over the decades by scientists across the United States and throughout the world. So they're pretty well known in terms of how they work, how they attack fungi, and of course, that they don't attack human cells either. So the risks are likely to be minimum at best. And like Nick said, we're already doing it with wine production anyway. so why not with beer, right, at the end of the day?
Nick, what could this mean for the industry as a whole? I mean, it seems like this could be a pretty big deal.
Yeah, we think so. My boss, Cole Hackbarth, and I we talk about this at length very frequently. There are just about 10,000 craft breweries in the United States. That's a lot of small businesses. So collectively, the impact of this could be, you know, especially as times tighten up during inflation, could be pretty large. And having a solution that could cost you as a small business maybe $1,000 to recover what could potentially be tens of thousands of dollars worth of product that you might otherwise have to dump, I mean, it might be the difference between survival in some cases for small businesses. So that's a huge hit to be able to take. And it really, because so much financial cost is on the line, it also incentivizes people to take those risks. And it's bad for the industry as a whole because, you know, bulging cans, exploding bottles, beer that tastes gross in general, that's not what we want. That's not our best foot. So
no, that does not help sales.
No,
I'm sure.
It does not.
Yeah. Well, and Cincinnati, you know, has this local reputation for this long, proud brewing history. Nick, how do you think this discovery fits into that? I mean, have you thought about kind of your place in history as like the father of the killer yeast solution?
Man, that makes it sound so amazing. Thank you. I have, actually. I in one of my lectures at Cincy State, I talk about Charles Fleischmann, who is the father of the Fleischmann Yeast Company. And he started his operation here in Cincinnati. He's actually buried at the Spring Grove Cemetery. And when I made that discovery, I was working at the Spring Grove Rheingeist facility. And it's just up the road from there. And so I would think about that from time to time about, yeah, there's a really strong sense of brewing tradition here. And beyond that, yeast cultivation history here in Cincinnati. And I'm very proud to be a part of that, actually. So.
Yeah. Paul, how do you see this playing out in your lab? I mean, you still have all these other kind of medical issues you're looking into, but how do you see this playing out in your lab? Are you going to become a lot more beer focused?
I mean, I guess it depends if we get the funding or not. That tends to drive where you put your eggs, right? But all I would say is, I mean, my research team here at the University of Idaho has been amazingly focused on pushing my research program forward in the direction of studying killer toxins and killer yeasts. My lab prior to that was focused on viruses of humans, HIV, Ebola virus, etc. And so we've taken this big shift. Because I have received some funding from the National Science Foundation. And so that sort of validated this approach. And so I've got rid of all of these other projects and have focused the lab wholly on killer yeasts now. And we have so many questions about the ecology of the killer yeast in the natural environment, the application of the killer yeasts again in human and agricultural disease, and of course brewing, but also understanding the fundamental mechanisms of these toxins and how they attack fungal cells. Mm. Because these are tools nonetheless for studying fundamental cellular processes. But also, again, potentially, if we understand how they work, we can engineer them and make new antifungals and new toxins that we can apply in a whole manner of different applications.
Well, I've been talking with Rheingeist Brewery Quality Assurance Manager Nick Ketchum and University of Idaho Associate Professor in the Department of Biological Sciences, Paul Rowley. Thank you for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.